From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We're going to tackle the state of the presidential race. Is John McCain getting a ride on Easy Street while the Democrats fight? And will the Democratic National Committee take charge of the race for the good of the party? For these questions and more, we've got Democratic strategist Donna Brazile. She's an author and a nationally syndicated columnist, and Ron Christie, vice president of the lobbying firm DC Navigators. He's also a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. Welcome.
Hello.
So, you know, is it busy enough for you? I mean, it's just like this race just has so many unpredictable twists and turns. But let's start off by tackling the Democrats. Hillary Clinton spoke out yesterday about Obama's decision to stay at his church. Here are her comments.
Given all we have heard and seen, he would not have been my pastor. You know, we don't have a choice when it comes to our relatives. We have a choice when it comes to our pastors and the churches we attend.
Donna, do you think that this is old news? I mean, things in this cycle seem to have moved on. Is it still a good time strategically for Senator Clinton to bring this up?
I believe so. Look, the day that Senator Obama delivered his speech, Senator Clinton was in the state of Pennsylvania, not far from where Obama delivered his speech. He was standing next to the mayor of Philadelphia, and she said that she felt that he had addressed the issues. A week later, at an editorial board meeting in Pittsburgh, she was presented with a question, and of course she said at the time that she would not belong to that church. What I find ironic in all of this is that almost 10 years ago, Senator Clinton, then First Lady Hillary Clinton, as well as former President Bill Clinton, called upon many of us, I was one of those, to reach out to the black clergy across the country to pray for the Clintons, to pray for their family during a very difficult and painful time in their lives. And I called upon many black pastors on a Saturday afternoon to get on a conference call to help the Clintons. And what I found ironic, especially as a fellow Christian, that she would bring this controversy back up without saying, you know, my prayers are with, you know, Jeremiah Wright during this hour of trial and tribulation. And, you know, she could have said it without reigniting another firestorm. But again, yesterday was a tough day for Senator Clinton. She had a lot of problems on her plate, you know, national columnists calling for her to get out the race because the math, you know, pretty much will not equal up to winning, as well as these allegations that she misspoke during her in describing her trips overseas.
Well, let me jump in on that, because we actually have a little bit of her talking about this issue of Bosnia and whether or not she was under sniper fire.
I remember landing under sniper fire. There was supposed to be some kind of a greeting ceremony at the airport, but instead we just ran with our heads down to get into the vehicles to get to our base. We landed in one of those corkscrew landings and ran out because they said there might be sniper fire. I remember particularly a trip to Bosnia where the welcoming ceremony had to be moved inside because of sniper fire.
Now, Ron, you'll notice that there were different tonalities. That's because this was from three separate occasions when she told elements of the same story. So this was not something that was a one-off, and now she's backpedaling and saying that she made a mistake. Is this going to hurt her, particularly since she's emphasize that she has more foreign policy experience than Senator Obama?
I do, actually. I believe that one of her greatest faults is that she has said that she is the qualified candidate, she has more foreign policy experience than Senator Obama, and that she has the wherewithal to lead in difficult times, and it plays off of her 3 a.m. Telephone advertisement that ran on the airwaves, where, of course, you know, if there were tough calls for the commander-in-chief to make, that Senator Clinton would be able to make them. It's a question of her veracity. Again, I've been shot at. I was in a congressional sponsored trip over in the Middle East in the 90s, And a lot of the people who are on television are now saying, you never forget when you've been shot at, particularly when you've been shot at for the first time. And for her to suggest that she had been in a combat zone and she had been in a war zone and they had to run to their vehicles and that, you know, there was no welcoming ceremony, and then you get the coverage of, in fact, Senator Clinton bending down and being kissed by a young girl, and there was a welcoming ceremony, it brings in the question, not so much the fact that she may have fudged the story itself. I think what it brings in the conflict and what it brings in the contrast for voters as they're looking for a Democratic candidate right now is, if she can't tell the truth about being in a simple arrival ceremony at an airport, what else can she not tell the truth about? What else perhaps is she shading the truth on? And I think this controversy is going to get worse for her before it gets better. And in my last point to what Donna just said, I think Senator Clinton chose yesterday as an opportunity to spotlight Senator Obama and his involvement with his pastor as a really last-ditch effort to deflect some of the attention that is being foisted on her as it relates to Bosnia. Anything she can do now to deflect attention away from her on this issue, I think she'll take, and I think that's why she waded into the Reverend Wright issue nearly 2 weeks later.
Well, let me go back to you, Donna, on the issue of what the party is going to do. There's a recent poll that indicates that if Barack Obama became the nominee, 37% of Clinton backers would not vote for him. Of Obama supporters, 26% said they would not vote for Clinton if she were the nominee. That speaks to a fairly fractured party. So what is the Democratic National Committee doing at this point?
Well, there's hardly anything we can do until the contest is over with in June. But at this moment, I think you've heard from leading Democrats. I mean, Speaker Pelosi has spoken up about the pledged delegates. Harry Reid last night issued a statement saying that competition is good for the party. We just need to keep it, in terms of discussing the issues. I believe that we should allow this race to continue. We know the odds for Senator Clinton. No one is encouraging her to get out, at least no Democrat that I know of. What Bill Richardson said over the weekend in his endorsement of Barack Obama was that it's time for the party to come together, and he's absolutely right. John McCain is now benefiting from this internal squabble, and we're not talking about health care or the economy of the war. Rather, we're talking about personalities and superficial things like Judas's and McCarthyism, which has no place in our party right now when people are suffering and they're hurting from this mortgage crisis.
Ron, let's actually go to John McCain. He has given a couple of major speeches this week, one just today on foreign policy. Let's listen.
If we withdraw prematurely from Iraq, al-Qaeda in Iraq will survive, proclaim victory, and continue to provoke sectarian tensions that, while they have been subdued by the success of the surge, still exist. I believe a reckless and premature withdrawal would be a terrible defeat for our security interests and our values.
I want you to analyze this on a couple of levels. One, what is the Republican electorate looking for from someone like John McCain on the war? And two, how well do you think this message of, you know, stay the course, essentially, is going to play with independent and Democratic potential swing voters?
Well, I think on your first point, I think what Republicans are looking for out of Senator McCain right now is a certain degree of stability. How will the Republican nominee for president look at what's going on in Iraq and what's going on in Afghanistan and the potential terrorist spots around the world for those who seek to harm the United States? How would Senator McCain's vision, how would his governing philosophy not only protect the American people against another terrorist attack, but to work with our allies around the world to try to mitigate some of the tensions and some of the flash spots to make the world a safer place? And that's what a lot of Republicans are looking for from Senator McCain, at least as it relates to that. His danger, it goes to your second point. Senator McCain right now is a one who is widely viewed as being popular among independents and among the so-called Reagan Democrats and those individuals who might be willing to cross parties based on his ideology and his record that he's amassed in the Senate. If he's perceived as staying the course, as you suggest, or continuing a policy in Iraq that doesn't seem to have an end date or at least has no clear public policy objectives, I think he runs the risk of losing and alienating those potential crossover voters that could propel him to victory along with Republicans. So he has a very difficult tightrope to walk of not only keeping the conservative base, who is a little bit leery of him to begin with, happy with his campaign, but also not run the risk of alienating those voters who might cross parties to vote for him. So he does have a particular advantage right now. While the Democrats are beating themselves up based, frankly, on a terrible catfight, Senator McCain is quietly able to raise money. He's here in Los Angeles today, was out in California yesterday, and has the ability to try to shore up some of those constituencies and to make the case while the Democrats continue to fight amongst themselves.
Donna, just very briefly, what do you think the Democrats need to do to attract swing voters and crossover voters, given the position on the war that is, you know, still fairly similar, despite the distinctions that Senators Obama and Clinton are trying to make from each other? Their basic position is the same.
Well, let me first clarify something. Ron said it's a catfight. No, that's too simple. This is a very major fight. It's really a past versus future. And I don't have to get into the particulars. As a superdelegate, I remain neutral, but it's a very important fight that the party must go through. And I think at some point the Republicans, too, will have to have this intergenerational fight. I think Democrats must continue to appeal not only to its base, but also to independents, to remind them that we have a plan and a strategy to withdraw our troops slowly, orderly, to begin to rebuild our alliances with our key strategic allies in the region, as well as to ensure that those who have served will come home and be able to get the health care and the assistance they need. Democrats have been very clear on this from day one, from the day we took over in 2007. But unfortunately, without having the presidency, we cannot change directions in Iraq, and we cannot change direction here at home.
All right. Thank you both.
Pleasure to be with you both.
Donna Brazile is an author, columnist, and political strategist, and Ron Christie is vice president of the lobbying firm DC Navigators. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. She says she made a mistake, but critics say she lied. Whatever the case, Hillary Clinton's recollection of a 1996 trip to Bosnia is the latest topic burning up the blogosphere. News and Notes web producer Jeffrey Bennett joins me now to talk about it. Hey.
What's up, Farai?
So what's up is Hillary. She said she landed amid sniper fire during a trip to Bosnia as first lady back in the 90s. Now she says she made a mistake when she told the story. What's been the response online?
Well, reaction from some of our regular bloggers has not been in Clinton's favor. The blog Field Negro wrote about it under the headline, "Maybe the Sniper Used a Silencer." And over at Jack and Jill Politics is the headline, "Clinton's Misspoke is a Lie." On our own blog, a reader named Randy wrote, "How can you misspeak about an event that did not even come close to taking place?" And Moji Odorinde summed it up this way. She wrote, "In an age of the web, candidates cannot afford such major slip-ups." And this topic is huge online. According to Nielsen's blog post, the number of posts about Hillary Clinton more than doubled since this news broke, spiking above that of Barack Obama for the first time in about 2 weeks.
Mm. Now, another big topic, LeBron James makes history as the first black man on the cover of Vogue, but it isn't all peaches and cream, is it?
Not at all. Yeah, some say the photo of LeBron and Brazilian model Gisele Bündchen plays on racial stereotypes. It's an Annie Leibovitz photo, which is on our blog, by the way, and it shows LeBron clutching Gisele's waist. He's sort of hunched over. He's baring his teeth. And some have compared it to King Kong clutching the damsel in distress. So we asked the question, is the photo racially insensitive, or are people just being oversensitive in their response? So on our blog, Bill M. wrote, "Why must African Americans exist in a self-imposed creative box? I'm sure people wouldn't care if it was a white athlete. Get over yourselves, people. It's just a picture." And Raul wrote, "LeBron James is a young, wealthy, famous man. He has press agents, managers, and stylists, but most importantly, he has agency. We should be careful not to divest him of the ability to consent."
Now, there's another installment of Speak Your Mind, our series that gives people the microphone. Tell us what's going on there.
Yeah, well, this one is from novelist ZZ Packer, and it's actually taken from NPR's Get My Vote. And Get My Vote is an NPR-wide initiative that gives voice to people who want to have a say in the political process. And there's more about how people can upload their own commentaries on our blog, NPR News and Views.
All right, Jeff, thanks.
Thank you.
Oh, there's also that weird picture from the New Republic of
there is.
If Clinton and Obama were put in a blender. You've just got to pop
right
over to the blog to see that.
Hillary and Barack equals Hillarock, apparently.
Yeah, a little scary. Anyway, thanks, Jeff.
No problem.
Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes, and he joined me from our studios at NPR West. On our bloggers roundtable, name-calling and mudslinging in the Democratic Party, plus a new bill in Maryland would allow police to collect DNA from suspects. With us this week, media consultant Carmen Dixon. She writes the blog All About Race. Josen Cummings, he writes the blog Broke Thoughts on King Magazine's website. He's also the editor. And public educator Avery Tooley. His blog is Stereo Describes My Scenario. Hey, folks.
Hey, Spry.
Hello. So let's start out with the political stuff. On Monday, the New Mexico governor and former presidential candidate Bill Richardson endorsed Barack Obama. He was also Richardson, a former member of President Bill Clinton's cabinet. So longtime Clinton advisor James Carville told the New York Times that Bill Richardson had committed, quote, an act of betrayal and, another quote, his endorsement came right around the anniversary of the day when Judas sold out for 30 pieces of silver. So I think the timing is appropriate, if ironic. This was coming up around Easter. Richardson responded on Fox News Sunday.
Well, I'm not going to get in the gutter like that. And, you know, that's typical of many of the people around Senator Clinton. They think they have a sense of entitlement to the presidency. You know, and I got in this race myself. I am very loyal to the Clintons. I served under President Clinton, but I served well. But, you know, it shouldn't just be Bush, Clinton. You know, what about the rest of us?
Avery, you know, this brings up a few different questions. One of them is, if somebody speaks out on your behalf, in this case, you've got Bill Clinton, Bill Clinton's surrogate, James Carville, in a way, talking about this act of betrayal. Should the Clinton campaign, should Hillary Clinton pay for that kind of strong language? Or is this just Carville out on his own?
Well, I think that to the same extent that Obama has to deal with the influence of what Reverend Wright said, then Hillary should have to deal with the same with any comments that someone surrounding her campaign makes.
Carmen, what about the question of how tense this race is getting? Is this going to turn off, for example, there's been a record number of new voters who've registered. Is this going to turn some people off, the tone of the campaign?
My instinct is that it already has turned people off to particularly the Democratic Party. It feels like a party that's eating its own. And I just don't know how it's going to heal itself by late summer. Don't see it.
Josen, do you think on just the fundamental level that Bill Richardson betrayed the Clintons, that there's something owed once you've held that kind of an office, a cabinet position?
No, not at all. I don't think he betrayed Hillary Clinton, and I don't think that it was Hillary Clinton's husband, former President Bill Clinton, that gave him the position. Just because your husband has done something for you doesn't mean that you have to reciprocate by doing something for the wife. I got friends who are married and I like them, but I may not like their wife. You know, it's just one of those things where you don't have to show loyalty to both people.
You better keep that. If you don't like their wife, you better keep that to yourself. Anyway, let me let Carmen jump in here.
Well, I just want to go back to Carville making the statement of in using Judas. He's a very smart man. What he did is completely shift the news cycle away from Richardson endorsing Barack Obama to his use of the word Judas, and the media followed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was an act of It wasn't an act of betrayal. I think that was a very emotional statement that he made, and it affected his judgment. If you wanted to say that Richardson was wrong for endorsing Obama because Richardson was one of the first to say that superdelegates should vote according to the way that their constituency voted, and you can point to New Mexico being in favor of Clinton, then that's a valid argument. To make it a personal attack on Richardson himself, to me, that's just foul.
Well, I think what we're getting is we're getting hard words because it's a harder fight than anybody expected it to be.
And a longer fight. It just keeps going on and on.
Definitely.
Let me switch to a new topic, though. There's a new bill proposed in Maryland that would allow police to collect DNA samples from people arrested for violent crimes and burglary. Now, lawmakers are still arguing about the bill's language. Currently, only convicts are in the DNA database. Law enforcement says a DNA database would help prevent crimes and catch more serial offenders. States including California and Virginia have similar laws that allow DNA collection upon arrest, as this proposed bill would do. So, Avery, you live in Maryland. What do you think the impact of a law like this would be?
It depends. I think it depends on the language in the law and how the law is used. I think that it could potentially lead to some abuses. But I also think that because there are a lot of people who could be exculpated by their DNA evidence, I think that it has a potential to be used for good.
So you think that it actually would help people be exonerated?
I think the potential is there. I'm not sure how it would necessarily play out in action, in real life, because I'm not sure. I think that the state, if the state is allowed to take that DNA evidence, I think that the state should be required to exonerate anybody whose DNA proves that they did not commit the crime.
Josen, one thing that I've heard is, okay, you're going to create a huge database of people who are innocent. And at the very least, you have to have provisions to destroy this DNA if, in fact, the person is not guilty or, you know, the charges are dropped. And there also have been cases where DNA evidence has been planted. Are you concerned that there could be abuses of this?
I'm concerned that there could be abuses of this, just like I'm concerned with any kind of laws that are put into place that that people can turn around and find a way to abuse or manipulate in the favor of a conviction. But like Avery was saying, you know, I think what this bill has the opportunity to do, if they pass it, and they pass it with the provision that, you know, this could be used to exonerate the wrongly accused, then I see no reason to let this fall through. That you should go ahead, you should continue, you should make sure that it does pass, because the way I see it, it's a situation where the glass can't be half full for a lot of people that are wrongly convicted.
So Josen and Avery seem to be mainly in favor of this. Carmen, how do you weigh in on it?
Well, I have a big problem with it for two reasons. Number one, as I understand it, there are hundreds and thousands of DNA samples taken from convicts that have yet to be analyzed throughout the country. And so I don't understand how that backlog squares away with now collecting samples from people presumed innocent now to solve unsolved crimes or to prevent crimes in the future. And my other problem with it is that it's simply a slippery slope. I remember the time when the eyewitness on the stand was incontrovertible. Legal thought was that the eyewitness is the damning accusation. But now we understand that eyewitnesses are often incorrect in their perceptions. So what's going to happen when DNA is planted? And I don't think it's as unlikely as some.
All right, I want to move on, looking into the rearview mirror over another recent controversy, the one over the Love and Consequences book. There was a recent Washington Post article by Stacey Patton. She wrote a memoir called That Mean Old Yesterday, and it's a tough look at her life growing up in foster care. But she was moved to write an article about Love and Consequences, the memoir that faked experiences similar to Patton's. Now, Love and Consequences was supposedly written by a half-white, half-Native American girl who was raised by a black foster family in South L.A. It talked about running drugs for the Bloods, watching a friend die in a gang shootout. It was all a lie. And the Post article by Stacey Patton goes on to talk about how the book reaffirms a longstanding white fascination with blackness and how, in her opinion, it's cool to act black without actually being black. Finally, she said, whose voice should speak about and interpret the black experience in America and whose voice white America wants to hear? Carmen, do you think that it's easier in a way for white Americans who take on, you know, black themes, for lack of a better phrase, to get their message out than actual black people?
Well, what sprung to my mind was the book Black Like Me, way back when the gentleman, you know, took on a darker skin tone and moved about the world, and it was this huge sensation. And so I think it is more sympathetic, shall I say, to a majority white audience to see the black experience through eyes like their own.
Mm-hmm. And Josen, do you think that it's a question of finding like a sympathetic narrator? A white person is viewed as a more sympathetic narrator than a black person? Or do you even disagree with the whole premise of what Stacey Patton wrote about?
I found some things that Stacey Patton wrote about I agreed with. What I'm glad that she pointed out was the Washington Post reporter Janet Cook in 1981 concocting a story about an 8-year-old black heroin addict. It's this thing where, you know, Margaret Seltzer, she lied about who she was. She lied about her background and everything like that. But what made it worse is that she actually does not come from this world at all. And I think that a lot of black people, they've never been exposed to that world that Margaret Seltzer was talking about either, but might feel prone to go ahead and claim some time spent in that world simply because that kind of struggle is so much a part of being black to so many people that they go ahead and they take that on too. So it falls on both ends, and that's what I liked Patton pointing out.
Do you think that there's like an addiction that even we in the black community might have to the, you know, the gangster narrative? You know, there's the whole thing of the studio gangster rappers who go in and try to pretend that they have street cred when they don't. Are we addicted to that whole scenario?
Yeah, everybody is. Hillary Clinton is. Right. That's why she lied about, you know, being shot at. We all like to go ahead and claim that it was hard, that we got to where we got to today because there was a struggle involved. It just makes for a sexier story all around. Nobody wants to be guilty of saying that they were handed their achievements on a silver platter.
So, Avery, it sounds like the question, there's a couple things here. There's race, but then there's also just adventurism. You know, how do you think this falls on the spectrum?
It's a combination of both. I think, as Joseph said, I think everybody wants to play a part in it. Even if you think of when we're kids and we talk about it here, we play the dozens. One of the stories that we tell when we play the dozens is who had it the hardest. Oh, man, I remember right. when we didn't have no light and we had to drink Kool-Aid, we had to drink cereal with water. So I think that's just part of how we grow up. And it does lend itself to some sort of voyeurism, though. Because people who are not part of that process will pretend that they were.
What effect does that have on discourse about not just race, but about things like poverty, where people, you know, there's so many stories, but the people, excuse me, who have the most experience aren't always the ones who are able to get the venue to tell those stories. How does that play out?
I think it makes it very difficult to get the authentic story. And I think it really makes it hard for people to understand, because sometimes someone who's not from that environment will struggle greatly to understand what it's like. Like for speaking for myself, you know, as a single only child of a single parent, you know, I did not live in the numbers. So like I always grew up with my own room and my own shoes, and so I don't know what it's like to be poor and to have to share, you know, pants or shoes or something like that. So when I hear somebody tell me that story, that's fascinating to me. And so, but the challenge is then not to appropriate that story and act as if that was my own story.
Carmen, do you think there's a place for, I mean, do we relate to authentic storytelling about struggle just on a human level that's important for us? And does every fake jeopardize that authentic storytelling?
That's an interesting question. I would say every fake doesn't jeopardize the authentic storytelling. I think it's always in the voice of the storyteller, and if it's compelling, if it's attractive to the reader. And we find that authentic storytelling can also get a broad audience. Depends on how compelling the story is.
All right, guys. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up there. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We've been talking with public educator Avery Tooley. His blog is Stereo Describes My Scenario. He was at our HQ in Washington, D.C. Josen Cummings writes the blog Broke Thoughts on King Magazine's website. He's also the site's editor. He was at our New York studios. And media consultant Carmen Dixon writes the blog All About Race. She was with me at the NPR West studios. And you can go to our blog, nprnewsandnotes.org, at nprnewsandnotes.org, a link to nprnewsandviews.org to speak your mind. It's a chance for you to take the microphone. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. So, do you want to fight Then call Eugene Robinson. He's always down to knuckle up. He's a writer for top magazines like GQ, but he also loves a bloody Fight Club-style brawl. Name the place from official rings to basement face-offs, he scraps hard and he scraps to win. His new book, Fight, is a tribute to the art of the beatdown. It's got a how-to on grappling and surviving broken bones, and it pays tribute to brawling legends past and present. Eugene, I'm actually glad you're not in the studio with me, but welcome anyway. So you don't pull any punches in this book. That is a pun intended. You deal with everything from professional fighting to informal brawling, like bar fights. You had an informal confrontation when you were about 15. Tell me about that face-off and what got you into fighting.
There were a couple of things. I mean, I think one was the occasion of being a loudmouth, kind of a smart guy, you know, and pretty much you're not going to be allowed to be a loudmouth smart guy and not stand up for yourself at some point or another. You're either going to have to do what they say, you know, shut up or put up. So the 15-year-old occasion, I think that was the first time when I realized that maybe getting a beat down is preferable to the other thing. You know, maybe swallowing it, turning the other cheek, walking away doesn't really sit well. I think I was in a bar in upstate New York near Poughkeepsie and had some run-in with four or five Marines. And I looked to the older guy in the group who was about 22, same age as the Marines, and he kind of just looked at his drink and did nothing. Now, in the fullness of time, it's occurred to me that maybe that was the wisest thing of all. But I think I was really looking to him for some sort of leadership thing. And that was like, let's all get the beat down together. And that never happened. And it's rankled me ever since. So I've kind of pursued this muse of.
Since you didn't get backup, you decided to learn how to be a fighter yourself. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it seemed like rightness was with us at that moment. And, you know, there's like this incredibly powerful thing when, you know, fired by the rectitude of the moment where you stand up and you say, no, you know, no, it's not going to be this way. There's a right and there's a wrong. And this is wrong. You know, to oppose these kind of forces to me seemed to me to make sense. And you needed to know how to do it if you were going to do it. So,
well, let's flash forward a little bit. You started doing organized fighting about 6 years ago, and some of them are kind of like that movie Fight Club, you know, a secret place, hard to find unless you know what you're looking for.
Right.
So how did you find out about your local fight club, and what was your first day like?
Well, you know, you're not supposed to talk about Fight Club, but I think somebody at my record label had seen something or heard tell, and they sent me a number. Said this could be just a joke or a prank or something, but you should check it out. So I called a number, and they kind of bounced me to a payphone, and from the payphone I went to like a, you know, some old apartment in the Tenderloin, you know, kind of an old 42nd Street style kind of section of San Francisco. And then I bounced down this kind of cranky old elevator to this basement that was, you know, just done up like a ring with heating pipes and pads on the wall and guys standing around taping their hands. So that was my introduction to Fight Club. I mean, I've been competing in karate and you know, competitive ventures for a long time, but this was the first time I'd done this kind of secret underground, no holds barred type deal. And I got knocked out the first night. That's how it went.
That sounds highly unpleasant. Now you mentioned
No. Actually, it wasn't really unpleasant. It was, you know, when I woke up on the mat, I felt incredibly refreshed. It was like, you know, the extraterrestrial kind of seizure thing. I my time had been stolen away in a weird way, but I didn't feel in total bad. I felt very comfortable.
Now, you mentioned your record label. You've got this band, Oxbow, and I would assume that with your fighting prowess, when people are stage diving, you know, you can knock them out too?
No, they don't do too much stage diving at our shows. I mean, our music, Vice magazine called us the greatest art rock band in the world. So it tends to be, you know, that you might find that in a Warp tour, but you don't really find that at an Oxbow show.
Have you ever had to apply a hand to a fan or?
Yeah, you know, we played a huge festival over in Bristol, England, and some guy had gone to write on his forum about the experience later, and he said he doesn't know what happened that night, but he had been drinking heavily and somehow thought that the best course of action was to go to the stage front and grab my crotch as hard as possible. And he said, I guess I shouldn't be surprised about what happened next. I'd like to think that he was inspired by, Dionysus and somehow found that as a way to act out. But I was very unhappy at the time.
And you expressed your displeasure.
I expressed my displeasure in the way that seemed most appropriate at the time.
Now, on a realistic level, a lot of people are going to listen to this and say, well, what's good about fighting? You know, you yourself are a father, and, you know, they might say it's not good for kids to hear that someone likes to fight. It's not good, period, for someone to want to fight. How do you respond to the idea that this is immoral or at least lacks common sense?
Oh, I think immorality has very little to do with it in this instance. It may lack a certain amount of common sense, but I'd like to say that I'm a standard bearer for a certain comfortability with reality. I don't see that this is something that you can avoid. I like the idea that they might have a problem with me liking it. That makes sense. I think, you know, in the West we have, it seems kind of retrograde that I would like it. But, insofar as my kids are concerned, I think it's part of a skill set that everybody should have growing up. It used to be the purview of the aristocracy, you know, from fencing societies to, Marcus of Queensberry boxing rules. These were the pursuits of the upper classes, not even 100 years ago. So if you were a person fit for society, this is what you did. You know, somebody might counter with, well, we no longer duel either. You know, we settle our disagreements. You know, we're guided by the rule of law. When you're in a bar and a guy is not letting you leave the bar because somehow he's chosen you in this, you know, great, you know, moment of flesh meeting flesh that you and him are going to, I mean, there are lots of options, but it would be nice at that point in time probably for you to learn, know how to defend yourself. Now, there's some people who have never had occasion and need to defend themselves, and to them, this might seem to be a very strange pastime, but I don't know many people like that.
All right. Well, Eugene, thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you.
Eugene Robinson is a journalist, rock and roll frontman, competitive fighter, and author of the new book, Fight. The tabloids went wild when pop star Britney Spears was taken into custody and ferried to a Los Angeles psychiatric ward. In the meantime, her father was gaining the reins over her estate. It's a high-profile example of the kinds of mental health cases that can end up in the justice system. Here at News and Notes, we've been looking at mental health issues as part of a month-long series. Today, our contributor Judge Lynn Toler is with us to explore what happens when the courts try to intervene in cases involving mental illness. Welcome, Judge Toler.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
So, you know, in your time on the bench, you've seen your share of mental health related cases. What's one of the most important lessons you've learned about what a judge's role or what the court's role is in that process?
I think the most important lesson is I learned that the court in and of itself, the way it is structured, is not the place for these problems to be. That the court system has a very few things at its disposal. They have jail time, they have probation, they have fines. Mental health issues are ongoing and systematic, and they deal on a multiple levels. The ability of the person to live, to make money, have a place to go, to maintain medication and medical services. And the court has very little ability, especially on the criminal side, to deal effectively with people who have mental illness who happen as a result of that mental illness to break the law.
Now, we all know about divorce courts and small claims courts, but there's also apparently mental health courts. Explain what that is and what those courts do.
A mental health court is something new. They have sprung up like other what we call problem-solving courts have done and to face systemic social problems that end up in the judicial system and have no other place to go. A mental health court is a place where if a defendant or someone who has committed usually a nonviolent crime comes into court, usually has an ongoing problem with the justice system, and there is a system in place where he gets an opportunity to go into a mental health court. There they deal with the problem The judge is educated, the prosecutor, the probation department, and they have systems in place to allow this person to get the mental health assistance that they need instead of dealing it with so much as a criminal problem, and keep the criminal thing over their head in order to allow them some kind of coercive methods, but to deal with treatment and housing and all the other things that will allow this person not to reoffend.
Is this for relatively minor or nonviolent offenses, or does this run the gamut?
Typically, it's for nonviolent offenses, people who stay in trouble for trespassing, or they're homeless, or disorderly conduct, or just out in the street and they sit down and cause a traffic jam. I mean, the things that you would see in a municipal court, which is not a felony, and these people reoffend on a continuous basis, and there is no system or anything to hold them up, so they won't get into trouble.
Now, in the case of someone like Britney Spears, she did not break the law before she was taken into custody for health reasons. If this is not a case where, you know, if you have a relative, for example, who seems to be on the verge and you want to have them involuntarily committed, that is, against their will, what's that process like? And talk, if you can, about the legal side, but also maybe the emotional side of what people have to do if they really believe that someone they love is in danger of hurting themselves.
Well, that's a very interesting question. The difficulty with that is oftentimes that these people will need medication, or they'll need some kind of support that the family cannot give. If the family is unable to do that, you can petition a court for conservatorship or guardianship. It depends. It's different in different states. What you have to do is present sufficient evidence and have that person evaluated, and there are determination made that this person not only is mentally ill, because mental illness in and of itself is not enough to have you controlled by another entity, but so mentally ill and effectively disordered that you cannot, that you're gravely disabled, cannot provide for yourself, or that you're in immediate danger to yourself or to someone else. Then a hearing is held and you go through that process, and a conservatorship can be had. That doesn't mean a person goes into institution. That just means that a person can have another person control their money, their functioning, their living, their housing decisions.
From an emotional side, though, what if you're that parent, that sister, that brother, who says, look, I'm going to try to take control of my loved one's life, and you know that that person is going to fight you all the way? What kind of advice on that level would you give to someone who is trying to make that kind of decision?
I would say that you have to, just like any parent whose child fights them all the way on the decisions to go to school, to eat vegetables instead of candy, you have to have the final purpose in mind at all times. And it's difficult, it is hard, but you have to have a sense of resolve about it and understand intrinsically you are doing the right thing for that person, not for your own convenience, because you want it, but because that person will be better off if you do so.
Let's dig a little bit into a specific law. There was a 1975 Supreme Court case, O'Connor versus Donaldson, and it set a precedent in mental health law. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Okay. In previous times, in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, there was a lot more people held in mental institutions, and it was easier to do. And in the Donaldson case, this gentleman's father had gone to the court and said, listen, my son is delusional and he needs to be in institutionalized care. They put him in institutionalized care, where he languished for 15 years despite his continuous efforts to get out. The law at the time allowed custodial care of somebody who was found mentally ill and not much more. And in the Donaldson case, they said, look, mental illness in and of itself is not enough. What you have to have is that they have to have some danger, they have to be getting treatment, and it has to be shown that some less restrictive method of helping to monitor or let this person live is available to allow this person. So you just can't say someone's mentally ill, confine them and keep them confined, because constitutionally everyone has a right to life, liberty, and if you're mentally ill, you don't lose that right.
Just quickly, how are prisons equipped to deal with people who are struggling with mental illness? I mean, if you do end up in jail and you do need treatment, are you likely to get it?
It depends on where you are. If you are in a small jail somewhere, and it used to be in my courtroom, I would be happy to have a person on a state charge instead of a city charge because I could put them in county jail. In my county jail in Cuyahoga County, they had a whole floor dedicated to psychiatric patients. They had psychiatrists on call. They had access to medication and ability to control that population or to deal with that population. If you are in a smaller place, you may not have that, and you do not have that access, and there's more warehousing and restrictive methods going on because they don't have any other way to deal with them. So really, it depends on where you are, what kind of law that you've violated in order to determine how well the institution where you are is able to deal with whatever difficulty you have.
Well, Judge Lynn Toler, it's always great to have you on. Thanks so much.
Always good to be here.
Judge Lynn Toler presides on the television program Divorce Court. She's also the author of My Mother's Rules, A Practical Guide to Becoming an Emotional Genius. And she joined us from station KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona.